Hey guys, it's Jesse. Real quick, before we get today's episode started, as many of you know, we have recently announced Love Thy Neighborhood's grand finale. If you are not familiar with that big announcement, I encourage you to go back and listen. As part of that announcement, I talked about the fact that we were trying to raise $120,000 to support this grand finale. And the amazing news is this: we have actually already raised over $110,000 of that goal. So many of you made that possible through your own generosity and sacrifice. We actually only have about $8,000 left to raise, and we will be at 100%. So if you have heard this message right now, you're listening to this, and you're wondering how you can help, this is it. I mean, we are right down to the finish line. We really need a handful of folks to step up. Whether you're giving a gift of $5, $25, $100, we would be so grateful for your support. Again, we really need to reach this goal in order to make sure that we have enough time to rehome the podcast, to give severances to our staff, and to support our ministry partners one last time. The other thing is also that we are running a big sale on all of our merchandise in our store. So if you have ever wanted some different Love Thy Neighborhood stuff, whether that is Say More cards or one of our t-shirts or something else, make sure you head over to lovethyneighborhood.org and click on the store button. Everything is a sale price that we've never done before. So we could use your support. Please head over to lovethyneighborhood.org and go to the donate section to give your gift, or head over to the store and purchase something. Either one is going to help us out a lot. Okay, on to the episode.
Love Thy Neighborhood.
Okay, cool.
Oh, definitely.
Awesome.
Discipleship and missions.
For modern times.
You're listening to the Love Thy Neighborhood podcast. I'm Jesse Eubanks.
And I'm Anna Tran.
This is Things We Couldn't Say About the Sex Industry. Today, we have three segments.
First up, Things We Couldn't Say, where we explore aspects of the sex industry that didn't make it into the last episode.
Second, an interview with Hannah Estabrook, executive director and co-founder of Sanctuary Night, about restorative justice and how to care for women vulnerable to exploitation. And finally, What Are You Doing?, where Anna makes a phone call to someone around the world to see what they're doing right now to make an impact on today's topic. Welcome to our corner of the urban universe. Okay, first up, Things We Couldn't Say.
Okay, Jesse, so a topic like the sex industry is very wide-reaching, obviously. And in our narrative episode, we really only skimmed the surface because our stories focused on just strip clubs.
Yeah, so we thought it would be a good idea for us to actually take a broader look at the sex industry, just to give our listeners an idea of just how complex and complicated this industry is. So to do this, what we're going to do is we're going to walk through the six different segments of the commercial sex industry. And to help us with this, we're actually going to be referring to an article from HTI Labs. HTI Labs is a research and technology organization that uses data and science to fight human trafficking. If you're a data person, you can actually just click the link in the show notes if you want to read it.
Okay, so before we start, one thing I really appreciated about this article was just how they broke down how tied up human trafficking is with each of these segments of the sex industry. So it really helped me see just how interconnected both those two things are, human trafficking and the sex industry.
Yeah, I think that's going to become more apparent as we talk. Also, I want to say this, a quick qualifier. You know, for the sake of talking about this subject as an industry, we're going to be using language like buyer and provider, and we really are not trying to ignore the fact that people are in coercive or exploitative situations. We're not trying to dehumanize people by using this kind of language. We're really just trying to simplify to try and understand the full range of conditions found in the sex industry. So with that being said, Anna, what is segment number one?
Okay, first segment of the industry, call girl and escort services. So in this scenario, imagine there's a man looking to find someone to have sex with. So in this situation, he'll either go on the internet and find advertisements, and then he'll either, you know, send an email or make a phone call, and then arrangements will be made for them to meet at some private residence or a hotel. In this situation, advertisements are really key here.
And the person that's kind of doing, you know, this is a gross way of saying it, but like kind of doing the brokering, like they would commonly be known as a pimp.
Right.
A lot of folks don't realize that Love That Neighborhood, when we got our start, we actually shared a building with Scarlet Hope, which is, the ministry that we covered in the mm-hmm. last episode. And so I was around a lot of, you know, these conversations on a regular basis. And it was shocking the number of women that initially thought that the guy that started eventually selling them for sex, they thought it was their boyfriend. They thought they were in a relationship with this person.
Oh, wow.
It's like a double tragedy because she begins to confuse love with this horrible exchange. It's a really tragic situation.
Mm. Yeah, so in this segment, the key is like the advertisement aspect of it.
Okay, so that's the first one. What's the second segment?
Okay, second segment, outdoor solicitation. So this is your stereotypical street prostitution. There are women, you know, or sometimes men, out in public spaces, like out on the street or at truck stops. And so then anyone who's interested in buying sex from them can just walk up to them and ask, hey, this is what I want. How much is it? And then this is where the solicitation happens. An exchange happens, and then they go to another location. The key here is that this is happening in a public space, so it's not indoors. And a lot of times it's associated with violence, drugs, and survival sex. And survival sex, I mean, like, people are doing this because they need money, and mm-hmm. they feel like they don't have another option.
Yeah. My wife and I were early on in our marriage. We lived in a neighborhood where at one point there were four prostitutes that lived across the street from us. And so, you know, what are commonly known as Johns, like they were going in and out all the time. And it's a tough call because on the one hand, I want to recognize, I mean, imagine what has to happen in your life that is the way that you're making, you know, your way through the world. So there's so much trauma and there's so much, I want to have compassion for that. And at the same time, I'm like, I have kids and, you know, so what is the balance here? And it was tricky. It was just a real tricky situation.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's the second segment. Talk to me about the third one.
Okay. The third one, picture and video sales. That's a pretty sanitized way of just saying pornography. And so this scenario, you know, there's someone who is very much removed from an embodied situation. So whether it's buying porn through a subscription service, whether it's buying pornography in a one-time situation, all of this happens remote or online. And so this part of the industry is honestly one of the easy ways people find themselves in it, because there's not a high barrier of entry and your physical body is technically not in real danger, especially for the woman or man behind the camera.
And in a lot of scenarios, I mean, really, Anna, as we talk through all of these things, you know, when I worked at the shelter, I would get together with somebody who helped women who were considering having an abortion, as well as Rochelle that was in the last episode. And we would all talk and realize that we were all serving the same client. The lady that was homeless was also the lady that was going out and working in these clubs to try to make money, was also the lady that wanted to go have an abortion because she didn't feel that she had the means to take care of a kid. And so we just have to realize like the complex tragedy of the whole thing.
Yeah. And these people come from somewhere. And sadly, there's so much extensive legislation related to pornography with minors and then child pornography because it is a reality in our world. And that's like a really, really sad reality that we're living with.
Yeah. I think the normalization of pornography in our culture has really hurt a lot of people because we think it's just innocent consumption. It is not. Okay, what's the next one?
Okay, so the fourth segment. So we have illicit massage or spa services. So in this scenario, there's a legitimate business like a massage parlor or a place where someone goes to, you know, get a manicure or a pedicure. However, these businesses are essentially guises where people can go in and make arrangements, call ahead of time to buy sexual services. These things aren't necessarily advertised online, but through word of mouth, people come to know that this is a place where sexual services can be exchanged for. Another common story I hear is that a lot of these larger massage or spa networks, they often recruit immigrants who are looking for jobs in the US in order to fill some sort of visa status. And so these immigrants see that there's a job opportunity and they say, oh, okay, let me go work here, be able to earn a living, and then eventually find my way into the US. But then a lot of times these organizations will offer like housing as well, or will use their visa statuses as leverage.
Basically turns them into like indentured servants.
Yeah. And so it's like, if you don't do the work that I want you to do, I'm going to take away your visa status, or I'm not going to give you housing anymore.
Yeah. You're at the mercy of the other person. Okay. So illicit massage, spa services. Tell me another.
Okay. Fifth one, brothels. So this scenario is specifically for lived-in locations. Residential locations like apartments or houses are where people stay, and then it's essentially where commercial sex is known to be provided on a regular basis. Through word of mouth, people hear that they can receive sex from these women at this house, so they go there, they pay, and then they leave.
And I think the real, like, the real allure for a lot of people to get end up working in brothels is that, unlike a scenario where like you've got just a pimp, the brothel appeal is at least I've got a community. At least if something happens, I can scream and somebody can help me. There's an appeal of community, of support.
Yeah, there's a security that people can have if they are at a brothel. Like, let's say the person in charge says that they're going to offer services to help them, you know, get their GED. If you work here, you stay here, food is provided, you get care for your children.
I hope as folks are listening, they can hear that this line that, you know, where does sex trafficking officially start? Because so much of what we're saying is about these baby steps where people are being coerced and led into and then trapped in these situations. It's not this just innocent thing between consenting adults. There are victims. There are real victims in this situation. Okay, I think you have one more. What's the last one?
Okay, final segment here. Strip clubs, bars, and casinos. So this is what was talked about in the narrative episode. So in this scenario, there are legal businesses, but these businesses act as contact locations. So buyers can go meet sex providers and then either like in another part of the establishment or another location, then the sex act is actually exchanged. These places, generally, it's a pretty well-known thing that this happens. Either the owners of the establishment turned a blind eye and they know, or they condone it, or they just have no idea. And people are coming in and out, and the clubs and bars operate as like a bridge.
My wife used to work for a ministry that, you know, worked with women coming out of the sex industry. And she would talk about like a lot of ladies sort of would take pride in the fact that they only danced and that they never participated in any additional sexual contact. But there were also a ton of folks that did and we're lying about it. And then there's a lot of folks that it's so interconnected. You know, they trace it backwards and they're going, well, I was trafficked in as a teenager. And then I got roped into shooting these videos. And then I got pimped out on these ads. And then eventually I ended up working in this club. I mean, it's like they can become a very interconnected system. Okay, so those are the six segments of the sex industry. So hopefully, you know, as you listen to this, you have just a broader sense, like when we talk about the scope of it.
All right, well, those were a lot of the thoughts we couldn't say in the narrative episode.
Stay with us because when we come back, we'll be talking with Hannah Esterbrook, executive director and co-founder of Sanctuary Night, about restorative justice and how to care for women who are vulnerable to sexual exploitation. We'll be right back. Are you tired of dull, awkward conversations at the dinner table, family get-togethers, or office gatherings? Well, we can help. Check out our Say More conversation cards, your ticket to turning mundane chats into meaningful connections. With 100 thoughtfully curated questions, Say More takes the guesswork out of engaging conversations. Use it during family dinners, date nights, parties, or even in the workplace. Watch how one simple question can spark endless, enriching discussions. The deck includes lighthearted questions such as, what is your most hated chore and why? As well as, what's your all-time favorite dessert? It also includes thoughtful questions like, what aspects about faith do you find difficult? And when you meet God, what do you want to say to him? Convenient and portable, Say More is your on-the-go solution for building better relationships. To pick up your deck of Say More cards, head over to lovethyneighborhood.org and click on the store button. Again, head over to lovethyneighborhood.org and click on the store button. Better relationships are just a question away. Get your Say More deck today and see where one good question can take you. Welcome back to the Love That Neighborhood podcast. I'm Jesse Eubanks.
I'm Anna Tran.
And our guest today is Hannah Esterbrook. Hannah Esterbrook has been working as a clinician in the mental health field for over 17 years and has specialized in providing direct services to survivors of the sex trade and sex trafficking. Her work with survivors includes settings in the criminal justice system. She co-founded Sanctuary Night, an organization serving vulnerable women at risk for sexual exploitation. Hannah lives in Columbus, Ohio with her husband, Brian, and she is the co-author of the book, Beyond Desolate, Hope Versus Hate, and the Rubble of Sexual Abuse. Hannah, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
We are really glad to have you on because, you know, this is a really important topic. Well, let's actually start here. What was the start of your journey working with vulnerable women in Columbus?
Yeah, thanks so much. And I think, as you said in my introduction, Jesse, I've been in the mental health field for a while. And very early on in my career, I found myself working, sort of specializing, I guess you could say, with women who had survived some kind of sexual trauma, most often child sexual abuse, and also found themselves suffering with a substance use disorder. And some folks might be familiar, and others will probably easily be able to imagine or intuit this, but when you have a combination of childhood sexual trauma and a substance use disorder, those two things combined are often, I mean, those are significant risk factors for repeated sexual exploitation, risk factors for entering the sex trade, sex trafficking, et cetera. Obviously, it's not a causal, like cause and effect kind of situation, but there is, again, those are just risk factors. So I sort of found myself within a few years of specializing with that population, interacting with women who had experienced, you know, traumatic things within the sex industry.
Tell me about what took a turn for you into doing something outside of the mental health field.
Yeah, good question. So I did shift to work within the criminal legal system. And the reason that that happened, and I'll try to provide some context and then feel free to ask any clarifying questions, but I started working for a program in our local court system called Catch Court. And Catch Court is a specialized docket. And for listeners who don't know what that is, a specialized docket is basically just, you know, the court system's recognition that there are groups of people who cycle through the criminal justice system because they have specific things that are unaddressed. So, for example, this movement really started in the late 80s, early 90s. The first restorative justice specialized docket was in Miami, Florida, and it was a drug court. Because again, we recognize, man, people are coming through this court system with these drug charges because they're suffering from an addiction, a substance use disorder. And so if we could create programs where they can address that addiction and get actually some support and some help, maybe that would be a better option than just having them go back and forth through the jail system. So that movement has really gained a lot of momentum. There are, you know, hundreds of drug courts throughout the country, but we also have mental health courts, veterans courts, and then there are somewhere between 30 and 35 human trafficking courts, right? So these courts are specifically the court's recognition that individuals who are picking up charges related to the crime of prostitution, that very often those individuals have not chosen to be involved in sex work, but that they were somehow coerced or manipulated into that context. And so by legal, you know, definitions, they might be considered human trafficking victims. And so Catch Court is one of the first in the country. It started in 2009 by Judge Paul Herbert. Mm-hmm. And it's a two-year program. So women can opt into the program again instead of cycling through our local jail. And they're referred to local treatment partners. They come to court every week and build community. They are given a mentor. Just tons and tons of resources are poured into these individuals. And then there's this beautiful graduation at the end of that two-year period at our state house. And it's just been a really, it's always just a really beautiful celebration because that 2 years is no joke. It's a lot of work. So I got to be effectively like the clinical director of that program. But I was using my clinical skills, but in obviously a very different context.
Mm-hmm. How often were women choosing Catch Court versus going, going through the regular system?
Yeah. Yeah. This is a great question. So, you know, and again, I left the court in 2020. So there have been some significant changes to the program since I left and also since Judge Herbert retired. But I will say that what we found in doing some research of all of the prostitution-related charges, and again, a human trafficking docket can receive any number of misdemeanor or even low-level felony charges into the docket. So it doesn't have to be prostitution-related, but those kinds of offenses tend to be a red flag, you know, that this is a person we should at least assess, are they being or have they experienced sexual exploitation? So what we did was then look at just those cases. And of just the soliciting cases, which is what the prostitution crime is called, at least in Ohio, over a six-year period, so we looked between 2012 all the way through the end of 2017, we actually only found that 4% of those charges were being even referred to Catch Court. Wow. Yeah. So it's actually a significantly small number. And again, maybe that has changed. I can't speak to data since 2017, unfortunately, but I'll just say that when we looked back, that was one of the numbers that really stood out to me in terms of, as wonderful of a program as this is, we have an access problem. Like, even within this courthouse, people who should be referred to it are not being referred. And then, of course, you know, of those 4%, like I said, it is a choice. People don't have to say, yes, I want to try this. So they still have an option to say, like, you know what, I'd rather just serve my jail days and be done with this case. I don't want to do 2 years of anything, you know? Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily a great number.
Mm-hmm. You know, I want to back up and talk a little bit about sort of the legal response to the sex trade in general. So it seems like there's just this really broad range of ideas when it comes to the legal aspects of the sex trade. Some want it to continue to be criminalized. Others want it legalized. Others want it reformed. Can you help us understand some of the legal aspects of the sex trade and what some of those common views are?
Yeah, I can. I think, you know, on one end, you have the folks who want to legalize sex work, although I think that's actually a really small group of people. There are those who want to advocate for decriminalization. And I would actually say that is the sex workers who identify as choosing sex work, you know, having full agency and autonomy to choose sex work, they typically advocate for decriminalization. And the reason for that is, you know, full legalization would actually be kind of almost like a step too far for them. You know, it would require mm-hmm. things like regulations, taxes, you know, mm-hmm. workers' comp, you know, all the things that most of us deal with.
But decriminalization is like, let us do our thing, but it's yeah. just kind of under the radar without a whole lot of supervision and protocol.
You got it. That's great. That's exactly right. And then on the other side of continuing to criminalize, you know, and arrest for this. And there are, of course, communities that consider prostitution a low-level misdemeanor, places where it's a high-level misdemeanor. So that can vary community by community. You know, I spend a lot of my time these days with people who are in street-based sex work actively. And so mm-hmm. What I can tell you is that, you know, they're not using their voice to advocate really for anything. They're just mostly trying to survive. But mm-hmm. what I can also tell you is that they do not view the police in a very generous way for good reason. You know, there, at least in our community, we've had police officers who have literally murdered sex workers. We've had police officers who have raped sex workers, who have required them to commit sex acts, you know, so as not to arrest them. I mean, there are so many of those stories that I've collected over the years. And those stories do lead me to believe that decriminalization would be, at the very least, it would be a trauma-informed response. Now, do I also know, you know, dozens of survivors who have said to me, like, Hannah, if I had not gotten arrested, I would not be alive, or I would have never gotten out of this situation or into treatment? Yes, I have heard those stories as well. And I think that's why I say that, just to say there can be maybe a nuanced view here. Mm-hmm. I do think it's tricky, and I can see it from many different perspectives.
What's fascinating too, though, is it even in what you're saying, in order for, you know, for the folks that think, well, of course there should be a really strong legal response to people engaging in these things, but that is also assuming that the legal system from start to finish, both the law and the order, like that it's all working as it should. Mm-hmm. And so that person is going to, you know, receive a fair response. But, you know, you're talking about the fact that, you know, in the real world, the legal system is not perfect. Things happen. There can be degrees of failure all along the way. So I just think it's important for folks just to think about that, and to think about, it's not as simple as, yeah, of course they should get arrested, and of course they should go to prison or whatever it is. Keeping in mind, the legal system does not always work as we want it to. Keeping in mind, the legal system does not always work as we want it to. I'm curious about this, you know, on this topic of people being trapped within the sex trade, what have you seen to be the most effective approach to helping survivors of sexual exploitation? And what have you seen people try that honestly just, it has not worked?
Oh, that's a good, complex question. I really believe that relationship is foundational to any kind of exit strategy here. You know, I'll just say that there's a popular phrase that's circulated over the last few years, thanks to Johan Hari's TED Talk, that the opposite of addiction is not sobriety, but that it's connection, right? The opposite of addiction is connection. And I think the reality is that I would say the same is true for a trauma bond, which is very, very common when someone's involved in the sex trade. Now, that doesn't mean that it's necessarily with a quote unquote trafficker, though it could be. A trauma bond could also be with, you know, just a boyfriend, a friend of some kind, somebody who is providing a survival something, right? Like, this is the person who gives me drugs, or this is the person who gives me shelter, or this, you know, that kind of thing. But also I'm a little bit afraid of that person at the same time, right? So that's part of the psychological dynamic with a trauma bond. And I think that's really similar to a relationship with a drug, right? Like, individuals who are addicted can feel both afraid of and grateful to a substance for what it provides for them. And so in both cases, I do not think that the quote unquote chains can be broken unless or until there is a network of a true, robust community that I can fall into, because the research suggests that a toxic connection is preferable to no connection. So if I have not built connections with people who are healthy, I probably will never leave a trafficker, an exploiter, a boyfriend, girlfriend, whatever, nor will I leave my drug of choice, because those things are actually keeping me alive. So I don't know if that fully answers your question, but I truly think any intervention has to start with a relational connection and building trust and being consistent. So I think anything that is a one-time service that's inconsistent is not effective. And for sure, my favorite thing about Sanctuary Night is that from our inception, we have prioritized being run by and led by survivors of sex trafficking and the sex trade. So out of 14 of our staff, 9 of them have the lived experience of having been trafficked on the streets of Columbus. And that's really important to me, because when a woman comes into our drop-in center, she's not just met with someone like me who's, you know, deeply compassionate. She's more often than not going to be met with somebody who has very much experienced the same kinds of things that she's experiencing and can relate to her. So I think that survivor-led interventions is another thing that I would amplify as something really, really valuable.
Mm. Listen, stay with us, because when we come back, we are going to continue our conversation with Hannah Esterbrook. Stay with us. For many young adults, you have had a blueprint provided for your entire life. You've known where you'll live, you've known where you'll go to school, what the expectations are. However, the formula that you have been following is about to come to an end. The laundry, the dishes, and the realness is all about to pile up, because you are crossing the threshold into adulthood. And for a lot of you, this is terrifying. There's good news. The good news is that you're going to survive. The bad news is that you could waste precious years of your life fumbling around in the dark, unsure of what next steps to take or who to take them with. But you don't have to be confused. We've created a free resource to help you. It's called the Quarter Life Roadmap, a 5-day guide for 20-somethings to discover who you are, what you want, and where you're going. In this guide, I'm going to help you understand which stage of emerging adulthood you're in and what that means. I'm going to help you understand the traits, experiences, and support systems you already have in life, how to identify your calling and your passions, and how to build your strategy for life. And finally, I'm going to help you learn how to face your fears with the courage of Christ. This highly interactive process is customized to your life and your experiences. To get this free resource, head over to lovethyneighborhood.org and click on the free resources button. Again, head over to lovethyneighborhood.org and click on the free resources button. You're going to get access to this as well as a ton of other free resources. Listen, you don't have to wander through your 20s. You need a map to guide you. It's time to reveal what that map is. Welcome back to the Love the Neighborhood podcast. I'm Jesse Eubanks.
I'm Anna Tran.
And now, let's continue our conversation with Hannah Esterbrook.
Well, tell me about, you know, Sanctuary Night. It's not an explicitly Christian organization. That's not something you like advertise on your website.
That's right.
But you are a Christian.
I am.
Yeah. Tell me about how your faith, you know, shapes this work and how that, you know, guides how you lead Sanctuary Night.
Yeah. I mean, my faith is the most important thing about me, honestly. And so it shapes really everything I do. And I, when I think about Sanctuary Night and what we're trying to do, I think about the kingdom of God. And I think about the kingdom of God coming to earth. I have a sort of a lovely balance of cynicism and optimism, I think, because I don't believe we'll see, you know, human trafficking eradicated in my lifetime by any means. But I do believe that the kingdom of God compels me to do what I can for the time that I'm on this earth. And so that is my personal commitment. And, you know, ultimately, when we decided to file for a 501c3, which was the moment, right, where we had to decide, like, what kind of nonprofit are we going to be? We looked through like an asset-based community development lens. You know, we just said, where do we see the abundance of God providing for us? And one of the things we knew was partially because of our connection to this criminal justice program that we had worked for and elected officials that we had relationships with because of that, we really felt like one of our greatest assets is government relations. And so in that case, we're going to be more effective to get across the finish line if we become a 501c3 and apply for specific grants that might not be available to us if we were a faith-based organization. And then the other thing that I'll say, and I'll come back to, and, you know, I had seen a lot of Christians wanting to do ministry work or outreach work with this population in a very evangelistic way. And I'm not necessarily discrediting that. I'm simply saying that having worked with this population now for over a decade, what I can tell you is that there's already a little bit of that exchange dynamic, obviously, because it's, I have to give you some sex act in order to earn money or in order to get shelter or food or drugs or whatever it is that I'm looking for. And so to be in any kind of relationship with a woman where I'm saying, in order to access these services, you're going to have to sit through a gospel presentation or a Bible study or anything like that, was something we really wanted to avoid. We love recruiting volunteers from churches, but that's something we make clear to them, is that this particular volunteer opportunity is not an evangelistic one in the verbal sense. You know, we do think that we're being the hands and feet of Jesus by what we're doing, but we're not there to force that on anyone. So I hope that makes sense.
I like what you pointed out, that there's a layer of, many of these women have, you know, come from situations where they're exchanging so much, like this for that. There's like this consumerist economy that is just like automatically applied. Yeah, that's a really, I think, important thing to know when it comes to like the women that you're serving.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it shows, you know, this idea of just knowing the people you're serving. Well, Hannah, thanks so much for joining us today. So if listeners want to connect with you and your work, where should they go?
Yeah, they can find us at sanctuarynight.com.
Wonderful. Well, thanks for joining us. It has been a great conversation, and we appreciate the work you guys are doing.
Thank you so much for having me.
And now it's time for What Are You Doing?, where Anna makes a phone call to someone around the world to see what they're doing right now to make an impact on today's topic.
Hello?
Hey, SK.
Oh, hi.
All right, tell our listeners who you are and where you're calling from.
Yeah, my name is SK Smith. And I am a Love Thy Neighborhood urban missionary. I am calling from Louisville, Kentucky. in my car on the way to what we call the Hope House, which is Scarlet Hope, a ministry here in Louisville, who works with women in the adult entertainment industry.
Nice. So you're going to do outreach night, is that correct?
Yeah. So we, as a group of volunteers, meet at the Hope House, and there's a kitchen there. And then we're going to go from there in pairs of two to strip clubs around town to share the hope and love of Jesus with the women there. And there is a kitchen at the Hope House, and meals have been prepared. So we'll take hot meals with us.
Yeah. So walk me through what a typical night looks like. First, you gather at the house, you get the meals prepared. What else goes on at the house?
Yeah, so we meet at 8:30. We kind of mingle a little bit. Then we do a little Devo. Sometimes we do highs and lows. Tonight we're actually sharing like ways that God has been faithful to us or to like people we know. And then we'll kind of hang around until about like 9:30, 10, or for one of the clubs, it's like 11:30. We'll go downstairs, grab the food, pack it up in, and drive to the clubs. We'll pray before we go in. We'll go in, we'll serve the meal and kind of ask people how their weeks have been. By now I have like some relationships developed, so I'll like check in and get to like catch up with some friends that I have in the club. Yeah, sometimes we get to pray for women in the clubs, which is really cool. And then when we feel like it's time or the spirit's like, all right, time to go, we head out back to the Hope House. Usually we'll pray out as a team by that time around like 1:30 a.m. So.
Oh, wow. So you're up for a long time then.
Yeah, it just depends on some clubs that are kind of get busier earlier on, and then some that don't get busy until like midnight. It really just depends on the night too.
Yeah. Tell me like what type of things like you've ended up talking about with women that you've met there.
Yeah, let's see. In the strip clubs, the women are called dancers, which threw me off originally because I consider myself a dancer, but like ballet, contemporary, tap and jazz stuff. So I can't just be like, oh, I'm a dancer, because they'll think like I'm a stripper, which I'm not. And so, but I was able to connect with one dancer who was a ballet contemporary dancer in high school, which was pretty recent for her. And so we talked about different types of dance and she even like pulled out her phone and showed me a dance she choreographed. That was pretty cool, just in the middle of the strip club. So, and then one time, like another week, I went in and she like did like, we were like just doing random dance things. It wasn't really busy that night. So, but yeah. And then other times we have like more spiritual conversations. So I had a conversation about like new age stuff and like what people believe in that sense. I've had like a few of those.
Cool. Tell me about something that's been an encouragement to you in the months that you've been doing outreach.
I think something that's very encouraging is like when we come back to the Hope House after we've all gone out, usually there are like some stories about how God moved that night. Before or after outreach, we'll hear stories about how like, oh, I got to share the gospel with a woman who I've known for like 6 years or something. We're like celebrating women getting baptized and like leaving the industry. But yeah, so stories like that have been super encouraging. Also just remembering, like, I started working at Scarlet Hope in September, but doing outreach probably 2 months later. So I really haven't been in the clubs for very long, and knowing that like these relationships like take a lot of time. And I've been like super blessed because I've been able to meet with two girls outside of the clubs already. That's kind of like not usual, but they're like my age and they're, I would say, like on more of the edge of the industry. I actually was able to invite both the women that I met with outside of the clubs to my birthday party. And they both came, which was like super crazy. That was really fun.
Well, I'm guessing you're probably at the Hope House.
I actually just arrived.
All right. Well, cool. Well, blessings. And I pray that tonight that, yeah, you feel the Lord's presence as you're talking with the women at whatever club you're going to.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks so much.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
Special thanks to our guests today, Hannah Estabrook and S.K. Smith. If you want to learn more about Hannah's work, go to sanctuarynight.com.
Senior producer and host is Jesse Eubanks. Co-host is me, Anna Tran.
Anna Tran is our producer and audio editor.
Music is from Lee Rosevere and Murphy DX.
This show is brought to you by Love Thy Neighborhood. To learn more about Love Thy Neighborhood, head over to lovethyneighborhood.org. Which of these was a neighbor to the man in need? The one who showed mercy. Jesus tells us, go and do likewise.